Today's scripture reading is Genesis 50, verses 15 through 21. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him?" So they sent word to Joseph saying, "Your father left these instructions before he died. This is what you are to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father." When their message came to him, Joseph wept. His brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. "We are your slaves," they said. But Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children." And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. This is the word of the Lord.
Good morning. Let me also welcome you. As Bijan said, my name is David Bisgrove, the lead pastor here. You may have noticed on page 6 that John Lynn was here at 9:30. He is the downtown pastor. Some of you may not realize that Redeemer is one church in three locations, and so I gave him the key just for an hour to come in at 9:30, and I took inventory. There's nothing missing, so we're good. But I'll be going down there at 5 o'clock tonight, and even though I don't have skinny jeans, I'll be preaching downtown. But as some of you know, I do have red suede shoes, and yes, I will be wearing them tonight. So that's far more interesting than any humanist Harvard professor, or I don't know what you're... So that'll be at 5 o'clock downtown, and I'll be back up here at 7, actually, and freak out the people at 7 with my red shoes right here in this row. But anyway, it's the reason we do that, I preach on the east side, Leo's been here, is because it really is affirming that we are a movement, an ecosystem. We're not just one church, the west side. We're trying to expand into the city and serve the whole city, and we feel like the best way to do that is to have multiple congregations. So actually, I'm thrilled to have John here this morning. Now, in terms of the series that we're in, a lot of you know we're in this season of public faith. It's really a whole year that we're thinking about what does it mean that if you're a Christian, that your faith is not privately held, but it's to be publicly traded, that to be a Christian is to extend the conversation of your belief beyond Sunday into whatever public square your life happens to represent, at home or school and with your neighborhood, at your job, and to do that in such a way that the only person who is actually offensive when it comes to Christianity is Jesus. Jesus does not need our help to offend people about Christianity. He's plenty offensive on his own. "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me." People bowed down and worshiped him. He forgave sins. He said he was the king. There's plenty of things that Jesus is and does and said that will offend New Yorkers. He doesn't need our help. So we need to live our faiths in a public way that just shows who Jesus is, that is humble and still bold, that is truthful but listens carefully, that is kind and loving to people who disagree with us. That's not easy. So we're spending the sermon series doing that. A lot of you in your community groups are wrestling with these issues as well. And so we come today to another foundational topic we've been looking at throughout the fall. And if you are here, by the way, this morning, and you're not sure what you believe about Christianity, there's always lots of people here like that. We have this great class, Exploring Christianity, right after this service on the fourth floor. It's designed specifically for people who are here who really disagree with Jesus, don't understand, and don't like Christianity, but are sincerely exploring the implications of that worldview. So we would love to have you join us upstairs on the fourth floor for that class or for another class that is really a basic class in kind of learning the vocabulary of Christianity. So they're both available, and you can find more on page 2 about those classes if you're interested. But the story this morning in Genesis chapter 50, this story of Joseph, really reminds us that if you aren't sure what you believe about Christianity, a lot of times, even though your struggles might be philosophical, they might be intellectual, or the things that if you are a Christian, the struggles of faith and doubt that you have as a Christian, even though they may be intellectual and philosophical, most of our wrestling with the truth and the reality of who Jesus is and what Christianity is and what the Bible is not intellectual, it's not philosophical, it's personal. It's existential. It's the story of Joseph. It's how do we deal with our struggles. When we look in the mirror of our lives, right, and we see trials and we see our suffering and we see the regret that we have because we know we're not the people that we have that we're supposed to be. Or we look out the window of the world around us and we see the Philippines and we see injustice and we see evil. And we find ourselves at time really echoing what the author of Psalm 73 said. If you go back and read that psalm, he's looking at the mirror, he's looking at the window of the world, and he sees the wicked prospering, and he sees the innocent suffering, and he says, my feet almost slipped. Right? I began to lose my balance. I began to question everything that I believed. I began to slip into despair. All because deep down, right, what is the question? Is there really a rhyme or reason to this world? Is there a plot and a pattern? Is there history that is actually moving in a direction in which there may be difficulties, there may be struggles, there may be trials, but in the end, there's a happily ever after? Or was Richard Dawkins right? Dawkins, who wrote, among other things, The God Delusion, when he said we have to actually just stop looking for a purpose. We have to stop believing that there's some grand meta-narrative that is being worked out in history. That in the end, this idea that there is some story is just a lie. Because he says there is no story, there is no history, there is no purpose, there's just genetics. And he writes, DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. My feet had almost slipped because I see the innocent suffering. I see hurricanes ripping through the islands of the Philippines. I see my own life and full of regret. I see my own mundane life. Does anybody even know I'm there? I'm going to live 60, 70, maybe 80 years, and in the end, I'm gone. What difference does my life make? My feet are slipping. Am I just dancing to the music of my DNA? And so we come to the story of Joseph. And the story of Joseph reminds us that there's a different music. There's another dance. There's another song that our hearts have been attuned to. And only when we, as the psalmist says, have to go into the sanctuary of God. See, if you go back and read Psalm 73, he says, my feet had almost slipped, but then I entered the sanctuary of God and I began to listen to different music. I began to see the story of God. I began to see that even that there is a plan. And that plan includes not just my joys, but my suffering. That plan includes not just my successes, but my failures. That plan actually is manifested through my weakness. That there is a plan, there is a dance, there is a song, and it's not just my DNA. That we find in the story of Joseph. And so we're going to explore how we keep our feet from slipping, if you will, by looking at Joseph's tears, his words, and then his story. His tears of longing, his words of faith, and in his story, a story that is yet to be told. So those three things, let's look at them together. The tears. Now, this is the end of the Joseph story, so to really understand, well, why is he crying, and what are his brothers talking about, and what's going on here, where is there a grudge? I have to summarize as briefly as I can, because this story started back in Genesis chapter 37, where Joseph at the time was the youngest of his brothers. He was a snot-nosed, narcissistic, 17-year-old spoiled brat. There you go. Because he was the son of Jacob, who had spoiled him. Jacob of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob fame had put all of his love and attention onto his youngest. And so it got to the point, it must have been so awful, he had so poisoned his family. And it started with his father, basically. But this is what his brother said in chapter 37, verse 4. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him. and they could not speak a kind word to them. This isn't just, you're going to have, you know, two coats and your brothers are going to have one. There must have been a deep, deep dysfunctional injustice in that home for this to be the seed, the fruit of their family tree. And so, of course, Joseph, like most young people, just lapped it up. He was a narcissist. He added fuel to the fire. He came out and told his brothers about these dreams he was having where they were all going to bow down to him. The oldest brothers were going to bow down to the youngest. And so that was it. One day when they saw him coming, what did they do? They staged his murder. They threw him in a pit. They sold him into slavery. And they walked back home and just lied to Jacob and said, well, he was killed. And they wiped their hands of the whole thing, and that was it. That was it. So, but it got worse for Joseph because he got sold into slavery. But then he landed on his feet. He was in the household of someone named Potiphar, and he was doing well. I mean, he was obviously a gifted, talented young man. And then Potiphar's wife tried to seduce Joseph, but Joseph didn't want anything to do with it. So he was accused by Potiphar's wife falsely of attempting to rape her. And so he was thrown into the dungeon for years, the mundane life of a prisoner. Do you think his feet had almost slipped? Do you think he was wondering, is there any purpose? Does anybody know I'm there? And finally, one day, Pharaoh was struggling with his own dreams. And finally, one of Joseph's former cellmates remembered, oh, yeah, that's right. I was supposed to tell you several years ago about Joseph. But there's this guy languishing in prison, and he can help. And so they bring Joseph into the presence of Pharaoh. He interprets the dream, and long story short, he becomes the prime minister of Egypt. Now, meanwhile, back on the farm, there's a famine. And so Joseph's brothers are facing extinction. The whole line of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the flame of hope, the plan, the history of salvation looks like it's about to go out. So his brothers have to go to Egypt. They have no idea what happened to Joseph. They figured he's dead, long gone. And they don't recognize Joseph, obviously, when they come into his presence and are asking for food. Now, I'm not going to go into that story, but it's because it's fascinating. But in the end, what Joseph does is that instead of hurting them, he helps them. Instead of revenge and vengeance, he offers them forgiveness. But despite all the goodness that Joseph had visited upon his brothers, despite all of the evil that they had visited upon him, they still don't trust him. This is where we are now. We're finally caught up. Jacob has died. They've brought him back and have buried him. And now his brothers are afraid. And Joseph weeps. Now, why? What are these tears, and how do they help us understand that we don't dance to the music of our DNA? As I was reflecting on it, his tears are the strongest argument, not a philosophical argument, not an existential argument, a personal argument against this idea that we are just the sum of our DNA, our genetic parts. They are a strong argument for that there is an overarching purpose in the world, that there is a story, that there is a history, that the events of our lives mean something, because these are tears of regret, these are tears of disappointment, these are tears of sadness, these are tears of longing. See, in Joseph's tears, we see our tears. In Joseph's brokenness, we see our brokenness, his brokenness at the world. We have a longing for a different world, a different story, a different outcome. Because everybody in here, regardless of whether you acknowledge Christianity or not, you know deep down that the music that you want to dance to is beauty and justice and integrity. See, these are tears arguing against the fact that we're just the sum of our genetic parts. Though everybody in here has this inborn sense that we have a shared sense of purpose and destiny in the world, and that we are to work together as a collective to shape history so there is a happy ever after, that the history is not a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury signifying nothing, that we want to be on the right side of history because there is a right side of history, and we weep when we find ourselves on the wrong side of history. See, my 5-year-old daughter, one of the only ways I can get her going in the morning is if I promise to tell her a pretend story, right? That gets her to the toilet. There you go. She's 5. Please don't tell her. But it gets her there, and she brings some combination of dozens of stuffed animals with her and a gun. And so we have to get into this story. And it doesn't matter what the plot is, because there's always tears and tension and bad guys and our feet are almost slipping. But in the end, it has to be, and they lived happily ever after. Because we will not get off that potty if it's not happily ever after. Because she knows deep down that's the way the world should work. She hears it in her, she's dancing to that music in her head. Several years ago, I was at the Starbucks here on 86th in Amsterdam, Columbus. And some guy was on the phone. It was a classic New York moment where he was talking so loud he wanted us all to hear. But he was helping somebody, a woman on the other end of the phone. And she had clearly been through her own terrible situation. And he was doing what everybody else does, would have done in this room, regardless of your particular philosophical or religious beliefs. He was saying, look, I know it's been hard. I know it's been difficult. You're going to be stronger because of this, and tomorrow's going to be a better day. Doesn't matter whether you're 5 or 55. That is the song that we hear deep down in our being, and Joseph's tears are evidence that it's true. But where does it come from? The sanctuary of God. You have to re-enter into the story of God to see who he is. Because even the most thoughtful atheists now acknowledge that any shared sense of destiny or purpose or this idea that tomorrow is going to be a better day, that we can work for justice and that there's beauty and hope in the world, even though they reject Christianity, they say it's borrowed from Christianity. It can't come from anywhere else except Christianity. This is a book written by John Gray called Straw Dogs. And if you ever just really want to be depressed, read that book, go to a Chekhov play, you'll be fine, because he's a nihilist. And he just buries any argument that there's any hope in the world apart from God. But he says, so he's talking about history, a shared sense of destiny, that all of the moving parts of our lives are working towards some sense of happily ever after. And this is what he writes. Neither in the ancient pagan world nor in any other culture, has human history ever been thought to have any kind of overarching significance. In Greece and Rome, it was just a series of natural cycles of growth and decline. In India, in the East, it was just a collective dream that was endlessly repeated. The idea that history must make sense is just a Christian prejudice. He's not a Christian. But he was talking about Nietzsche at this particular point in the book. And he was upset with Nietzsche because he couldn't escape his Christianity, even though he said God was dead. He kept borrowing Christianity. Because the only way you can have any hope in the world is that tomorrow's going to be another day, that there's going to be a happily ever after, that your life means anything, comes from the sanctuary of God. It's a Christian idea that our lives are part of something big. Because why? Everybody in this room images God. You were all made in his image. See, Christianity is the most dignifying and empowering of all the views of humanity, because it reminds us that our lives do matter, that we have been given choice and power and freedom to shape history, to shape the world around us, to go into the public square for the public good. And therefore, we collectively weep and mourn and have regret and sadness, because we know that the world in which we live falls far short of that. See, you were created by a God who weeps. Jesus wept at the tomb of his friend Lazarus. Jesus on Palm Sunday, when everybody around him is celebrating and having a party, what does he do? He looks at Jerusalem and he breaks down in tears. You have to go into the sanctuary of God. You weep over the world. You weep over your life because you were created by a God who weeps. There is no other religion, no other place that you can find that but Christianity. So that's the tears. They reveal a longing. They argue against any sense that we're just the sum of our parts. And they argue for that there is a happily ever, that there is a sense of shared history, that your life does matter, that even the worst possible things are being used by God. That's where we're going to go next. So, knowing that, though, isn't enough, right? It's inspiring, it's great, but we still got to leave. still got to go back into the world. So what else do we need? We don't just need the tears of longing. We need the words of faith that we have here. That we need to listen to the words of faith that Joseph gives us if we're going to overcome evil with good. If we are really going to become a community of people who forgive our enemies, if we're really going to see our suffering and our pain as something that God is using, we have to hear the words of faith. Verses 19 and 20. See what he says there? Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? They're afraid that he's going to do what? With the natural instinct, vengeance, right? Don't be afraid, Joseph says. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. These are the words of faith that we need to marry with the tears of longing that we have. Now, one commentator, Derek Kidner, who wrote this beautiful little commentary on Genesis, said that these words are really the pinnacle of Old Testament and therefore New Testament faith. They are the pinnacle of biblical faith because they do give us the foundation and the vocabulary and the power to actually live through our tears and to live just lives and to have hope and to overcome evil with good. How? First, when he says, am I in the place of God? Am I in the place of God? That is an antidote to the poison that had been destroying the family of Joseph for years, stretching all the way back to his grandfather Isaac. The hatred, the vengeance, this cycle of violence that had been going into their family had poisoned their family tree. When he says, am I in the place of God? He stops the cycle of violence right in its tracks. See, everybody in this room knows that the way to get out of ethnic cleansing, the way to get out of war, the way to get out of racism, the way to get out of all those things is that somebody has to stop. I mean, Elie Wiesel puts it this way, a hate is contagious. It's like cancer. If unchecked, it will destroy the body which nurtures and carries it. Ultimately, hate is both destructive and self-destructive. Hate inevitably leads to self-hate. Revenge and vengeance never works. It just is an accelerant that just keeps the revenge cycles going. So when Joseph says, am I in the place of God, we finally have an antidote to that, a practical way, a way in which we can fight for justice without being the judge. Right? That's the key, right? How do you fight for justice? How do you care for justice? How do you care about the inequities of the world and yet not pick up the sword yourself? By saying, am I in the place of God? Because those are words of humility and hope. On the one hand, he says, who am I to judge? That's humility. Who am I to pick up the sword? This is above my pay grade. How can I possibly know all of the inner workings of somebody else's life and judge them? These are words of humility. You can't possibly know the motives behind, the heart behind. You can't possibly know what God might have in store for that person. So who am I, he says. See, you want to know biblical wisdom boiled down to one phrase? There is a God and you're not him. There is a God and you're not him. See, all of my problems and all of your problems begin when we begin to think we know better than God. Am I in the place of God? It humbles him because he knows that any attempt at justice will be tainted by revenge and vengeance. He can't be objective. He can't because he's not perfect. So there's humility, but yet that's not enough. There has to be hope, right? Because he knows that in order to break the silence, break the cycle of violence, somebody has to be in the chair. Somebody has to be in the place of God. There has to be a judge. Miroslav Volf, who wrote this seminal book, Exclusion and Embrace, who lived through and witnessed some of the worst atrocities of the Croatian Wars. He writes the fact that it's just, he says, it takes the quiet of a suburb for the birth of the thesis that human nonviolence is the result of a God who refuses to judge. Hear that? It takes the quiet of a suburb. It takes comfort. It takes that it's not your sister that's being raped. It's not your village that's being bombed. Takes the quiet of a suburb for the birth of a thesis that human nonviolence is the result of a God who refuses to judge. In a scorched land soaked in the blood of the innocent, that idea will invariably die. Because if God were not angry at injustice and deception, and did not make a final end of violence, that God would not be worthy of our worship. Hear what he's saying? That only the fact that there is a judge, there is a perfect judge on the throne who one day will pick up the sword, I can lay my sword down. Right? Otherwise, it's every man for himself. You know, what if you were mugged and robbed and they caught the person who did it and you showed up at the court and they had the guy red-handed, there's your iPod right there, or pad or phone or whatever the I thing is that he stole. And the judge says, well, yeah, but who's really to say what's right and wrong? What's really justice or wrath? I don't like wrath. You would say, well, if you don't do it, I will, right? We all become Charles Bronson in Death Wish. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4. There were like 17 of them. But in other words, if you're not going to take up the sword, I'm going to take up the sword. That's what he's saying here. The only way to stop the madness, to break the cycle of violence, is to have the humility that you're not God, but the hope that he is, and he's on the throne. And one day he's going to make every crooked straight place. So that's how he can do it. Listen to his words. So, but secondly, he also we have to take into our hearts the other words that follow on that verse, which is that you intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, for the saving of many lives. You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, for the saving of many lives. In other words, he's not just the judge with a sword, but he is the king with a scepter. Not just the judge with a sword, but he is the king with a scepter. He is working all things together for good. Now, this is an incredibly complicated topic, but for the purpose of this sermon, Joseph is looking back over the horizon of his life, filled mainly with injustice and pain. And he looks back over it in such a way, all of the lost years, all of the evil, all of the pain, and he says, God used all of that in such a way for his salvation. He's used the tragedy of my life to bring death, to turn death into life. That is a remarkable, remarkable position to hold. And again, it doesn't exist anywhere else except in the sanctuary of God. That is not romanticism, in which we say, well, it's all going to work out in the end. You know, we wear our rose-colored glasses. It's not fatalism. Like Oedipus, well, you just know you have no control over your life. Things just happen. Or it's not cynicism, in which you just dance to the music of your DNA and it doesn't really matter how you live your life, so it doesn't matter who you really hurt in the end, because there is no right and wrong. You have to go into the sanctuary of God and see it does matter. Your life does matter. Your choices do matter. You're responsible for your choice, but in the end, God has ultimate sovereign responsibility and will take all of your free choices and work them out in such a way for the saving of many lives. Proverbs 16:9, in their hearts, humans plan their course, but the Lord establishes their steps. In their hearts, we plan our course, but the Lord establishes our steps. See, the Bible says we don't understand how, but actually we know existentially, we know in our lives, this is how we live our lives, that God is working things out in such a way that he doesn't violate our responsibility, and yet he is still working out his plan in history. That we're fully responsible for our actions, but those actions are completely under the sovereignty of God, and he's working them out for the saving of many lives. Joseph saved thousands of lives from death by becoming the prime minister of Egypt. And the only way he became the prime minister of Egypt is through injustice and evil and pain and suffering. God used that to save thousands and thousands of lives. But he also saved the souls of his family. That through the pain and the justice and the injustice and the suffering, he used that as an antidote to neutralize the poison of the sin that had been corrupting his family for generations. He was able to look back and say, God is at work in history through my pain, through injustice. See, what is history? History is a series of events that have a meaning and a purpose and an end. There is, and all of history has its meaning, and this is the Christian view, right? In God's plan of salvation. It started in Genesis chapter 3. He could have ended history right there, but all of history The meta-narrative of all of history is God's saving of many lives. That is the meaning of history. And God is using evil and injustice and working them into his plan. So the implication this morning, if you're here and you're a Christian, is that you are here for the saving of many lives. That God is working out his historical plan of salvation through your parenting. He's working out his plan of salvation, saving of many lives, through you doing your job in an ethical way. He's using you, your actual pain and suffering that you're going through, to encourage other people who don't know him. He's using your prayers for people that you know and love and care for. He's using you, for the saving of many lives. That's the story of Joseph. That's the practical implication. There is no plan B in your life. Everything is being used by God. You are uniquely helping people that I will never meet, that other people in this room will never meet. Everything is being used by God in your life for the saving of many lives. You know, when I came to New York, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was thinking about going to grad school, and I had choices, and I was thinking about going to seminary back in the late 80s or going to become a counselor, but then I had this opportunity to come to New York and go to business school. And I just made a very, what I thought, pragmatic decision to come to New York and go to Columbia and live in the city and would be here a couple of years. But a couple of months later, my dad was diagnosed with cancer and died within 6 months. So if I had been somewhere else other than New York, I would have had to move back. He was treated at Sloan Kettering. My best friend at business school was living with some guy who was getting his PhD at Columbia, who mentioned that there was some church being started somewhere in the Upper East Side by a guy named Tim Keller. I was hired to work in Sloan Kettering at a grad school. And I started to attend Redeemer when there were about 75 people there. Yada, yada, yada. Here I am. There's a lot of yadas. There's a lot of struggles. There was a lot of pain. But the point is, I had no idea that God would weave all of those things together so that I would be standing here this morning. And that's just me. I'm not better or different than God. That's what God is doing. But it takes perspective to look back. In the moment, you feel like, I have no idea if anybody even knows I'm here. God knows you're here. God knows you're here. And you're here, if you're a Christian, for the saving of many lives. In the public square, for the common good, by fighting for justice, by sharing your faith, by praying. It's all part of his plan. You are part of history. There is no more dignifying plan for humanity than what God is doing through you. So, got to finish up here. The tears of longing remind us that we were built for a dance that is not our DNA. The words of faith remind us and give us hope and humility that there is no plan B, that God is using everything in our lives to save, to bring about his plan of salvation, which is the whole point of history to begin with. And then lastly, there's the story not yet told through Joseph's story. Now, you know, there's a temptation to read the Bible. If we were to end the sermon now and say, well, that's very inspiring, and then we go out into the world and we go back into the mess that is our lives and the mess of the lives that are people around us, and the inspiration would last about as long as three stops on a subway train, and then we'd be thinking, I can't do this. How? I can't be Joseph. I can't be like Joseph. I can't persevere through trials. I can't forgive and love my enemies. I can't put down the sword. I can't be patient in suffering. I can't, you know, in those subway platforms, and I go down to the one train, and if it's more than 5 minutes wait, I get so ticked off. You know, or I walk into a Starbucks and there's three people in front of me, I leave. I mean, be like Joseph. There's no way. It doesn't inspire me. It crushes me. But the Bible is not a series of unrelated Aesop fables to give us moral courage to go out and live like Joseph. Joseph couldn't live like Joseph. The whole point of the Bible is that it's not about Joseph. And the whole point of the Bible is that it is supposed to crush you. It is supposed to empty you of any self-reliance. It is supposed to show you your weakness, because in the end, every story points to the story of Jesus. And it's in Jesus' weakness on the cross that we begin to see that's how we find the power. That's how we find the inspiration. That's how we overcome evil with good, because Jesus overcame evil with good. through a series of what seemed like impossible injustices and evil. So yeah, you know, the movie The Sixth Sense, and it's been out so long, so the statute of limitations is up, so I'm just going to ruin the movie for you if you haven't seen it. But it's Bruce Willis, and he's this therapist, and the whole movie of 2 hours, fascinating movie, right? He's in all these scenes, and it seems like he's talking to other people, and he's engaged. And then the very last scene, you realize he's a ghost. That he's actually, he had no idea that he wasn't even alive, that he was just witnessing things, that he wasn't part of the story. You can never watch that movie again the same way. Once you know that that's what his character is, it changes the movie forever. See, the story not yet told, once you hear the story of Jesus, you can never read the story of Joseph the same again. You can never read the story of Moses the same again. You can never read the story of Abraham, of Ruth, of Esther, of anybody. Because the Bible is about Jesus. Every page from Genesis to Revelation is about Jesus. Because like Joseph, Jesus was rejected by his family, by his community, and he was sold for silver coins. Like Joseph, Jesus was put in prison unjustly. Isaiah says he was numbered with the transgressors. Like Joseph, Jesus was banished from his community in order to save that community through that banishment, through that injustice on the cross. Like Joseph, Jesus was only exalted to the right hand of the throne. Why? Because he fell all the way low into the depths of hell. And like Joseph, Jesus intercedes today at the right hand of God the Father for you, saving you, helping you, praying for you. Like Joseph stood at the right hand of Pharaoh and interceded on behalf of his brothers. It's all about Jesus. This Joseph story points to the Jesus story, which points to the ultimate story of the Bible, that he is the king who became a lamb. So like Joseph, you could get the robe and the ring of the king. He is the judge who is condemned so that Paul could write, there is no condemnation for anybody in this room if you put your faith in Jesus. He was the one on the cross that said, forgive them, us, his enemies, so that we could turn around and forgive our enemies. It's the tears of Jesus that heal us. That's who the tears of Joseph point to. See, you see that the story of Jesus, the story of Joseph, which is the story of Jesus, challenges everybody in this room and say, am I on the right side of history? Do I have my feet firmly planted in the story of Jesus? That's why worship is so important, right? Because in our discouragement, in our brokenness, when we come into worship every week, what do? We re-enter the sanctuary of God, and we hear the story of Jesus over and over and over and over and over again. There is a happily ever after. In 1983, the Time magazine cover story was about Pope John Paul II. And, you know, there was an attempt on his life. He was shot. And so the Pope went to the prison to visit with him. And this is just a reminder of what every heart in this room dances to. And this is what the author wrote. Let me just close with this. The scene in the prison had a symbolic splendor. It shone in lovely contrast to what the world had witnessed lately. Because for some time, a suspicion had taken hold that the trajectory of history is descendant. That the world moves from disorder to greater disorder. That we're just dancing to the music of our DNA. But the symbolism of the pictures from the prison is precisely the Christian message that people can be redeemed and that they are ascendant towards the light. See, the story of Joseph is the story of Jesus and is not just a window into the future, into the present in which you can have hope today, but into a future in which God will wipe away all of your tears and turn our mourning into dancing. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for the tears of Jesus. We thank you for the words of Jesus. We thank you for the actions of Jesus in which he lived the life that we could not live and was crushed on the cross so that we could stand in your presence forever and sing. Help us as we leave this place today to live out the story of Jesus through our brokenness, through our suffering, through our successes, through our joys, and point to him who stands at your right hand. We ask all these things in his precious name. Amen.